This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Domestic spying, the law, and the politics. Hello again, I'm Oren Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Even some Republican senators say President Bush is making an illegal power grab by claiming authority to wiretap Americans without a court order. That's what the Democrats think, but they're treading carefully so as not to seem weak when it comes to the threat of terrorism on American soil. On To the Point, we'll hear a debate about law and the Constitution and ask what the polls show about public opinion. Will the voters crack down if they see an abuse of executive power, or let the president strike a balance between civil rights and the war on terror? On Reporter's Notebook later, how did the protest over cartoons of Muhammad go from Denmark to the rest of the world? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Mormon Alney back with To the Point. President Bush says the law and the Constitution give him the authority to wiretap Americans without a court order. On To the Point, even many Republicans say that's an abuse of executive power. But can Democrats make it an issue in this year's campaigns? On Reporter's Notebook, did Danish imams orchestrate worldwide protest over cartoons of Muhammad? First, this news update. Former Presidents Carter, Clinton, and Bush were among the 10,000 people at the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church near Atlanta today at the funeral for Coretta Scott King. The current president was one of those who delivered a eulogy.
Americans knew her husband only as a young man. We knew Mrs. King and all the seasons of her life. And there was grace and beauty in every season. As a great movement of history took shape, her dignity was a daily rebuke to the pettiness and cruelty of segregation.
President Bush today at the funeral of Coretta Scott King, he also called her one of the most admired Americans of our time. Dr. Vicki Crawford is Associate Professor of History at Clark Atlanta University. She's co-editor of a book, Women in the Civil Rights Movement, Trailblazers and Torchbearers, 1941 to 1965. Dr. Crawford, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
A lot of people at that funeral today, Stevie Wonder, Maya Angelou, Oprah Winfrey, in addition to the political leaders. Very interesting that your book that you co-edited ends with the year 1965. Was Coretta King really a civil rights leader before then, or was it after her husband was assassinated in 1968?
I think Coretta King was very involved beginning with the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. And again, I think women's roles have been undervalued, certainly by some historians and by the media. You know, they're different kinds of leadership. And I think she, from the outset, having arrived in Montgomery, was very involved behind the scenes in terms of work with the Women's Political Council there and the boycott. So I'd say that, I mean, she had a behind-the-scenes role. And it began long before 65.
It's often said that Dr. King himself had a rather traditional view of the role of women, and that as far as he was concerned, she was a housewife. I take it you wouldn't agree with that either.
Well, I think given the context of the times, I know that was true. But at the same time, as we look back, I think, again, she had a different kind of influence. Certainly, she wouldn't have been out front. She wasn't a spokesperson. But I think now we're beginning to value the different kinds of roles women have had. Certainly, a woman like Dorothy Cotton, Miss Dorothy Cotton, who was very involved in Southern Christian Leadership Conference, she talked about the male chauvinism, but at the same time, she was there trying to exert herself. I think about Ella Baker and women who spoke out about male sexism at the time, but at the same time, they were still there leading in their own ways.
talking with Dr. Vicki Crawford at Clark Atlanta University. Something like 160,000 mourners came to pay their respects to her at the Ebenezer Baptist Church earlier and at the Georgia Capitol. She was the first woman and the first African American ever to be laid in state in the Georgia Capitol. That's really an extraordinary
effect. That is extraordinary. And last night I was at one of the memorial services. There have been many memorial services here in the city. I mean, they've been to packed capacity. Last night's service was at Ebenezer Baptist Church, and you could see we had it was a cold night and a rainy night here, and there were the media reported over 46,000 people who had come through to view the body yesterday. At that service last night at Ebenezer, I mean, it was just a packed, crowded to capacity, so people loved her. You know, she was criticized by some, but you could just see that she represented hope. She was symbolic, and people turned out.
How important do you think she was, particularly to women?
I think very important to women. As I listen to some of the sound bites from TV people, women being interviewed, certainly in speaking for myself, I mean, she represents for Black, particularly for African American women, and I think for all women, she's representative of what women of our kind of leadership, of our way her connection in terms of human rights, how she saw civil rights. She did not, I think, didn't just see civil rights as a single issue, but she clearly saw the interconnection of human rights, civil rights, anti-racism work, and saw those connections, particularly in terms of the work with women, with children and youth. So in that way, for women, I think women who are mothers. And have family responsibilities.
We just have a couple of seconds left, but Betty Friedan died recently as well. I take it Coretta Scott King was not a feminist in the same sense.
I would agree. And I think when Black women use the term womanist, I think that speaks to that African-American women's history has been very different from the history of white middle-class women in this country. For example, African-American women have typically had to work, and we've worked outside of the home. I remember Betty Friedan's The Feminist Mystique, and that's one thing that she talked about, the problem that has no name, and this wanting to, this yearning to work outside the home. So I think our histories are different. I don't think Coretta King would have called herself a feminist.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Vicki Crawford, Clark Atlanta University. In a moment, domestic spying, the law, and the politics on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. After senators of both parties spent the day grilling the U.S. Attorney General, Republican Committee Chair Alan Spector said he was not persuaded by Alberto Gonzalez. The issue was whether President Bush acted legally when he authorized warrantless wiretaps of American citizens communicating with suspected terrorists overseas. Michael Isikoff has been reporting this story for Newsweek magazine. And, Michael, it's always good to talk to you.
Good to be with you.
What did you observe at yesterday's hearing? What do you think were the most interesting things to come out of it, politically speaking?
A lot of frustration on the part of senators on both sides of the aisle, primarily all the Democrats, certainly, but even some Republicans, Spector, Senator DeWine, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, all expressed some real reservations about what the White House and the administration has been doing here, and absolutely nothing from Attorney General Gonzalez in terms of answering any questions about what the program entails and when the administration reached the kinds of legal conclusions it did. I mean, there was a sort of starting premise. I'm not going to give you any operational details or anything that might remotely relate to operational details. Which has made so much of this debate in a vacuum. It's very hard to know how much, if and how much they are stretching the law without knowing precisely or even generally what they're doing here. So, I mean, what you have is, on the one hand, the White House and the Attorney General talking about this saving lives and being important to the national security and tracking terrorists, and the Democrats saying, well, how are we supposed to judge that when a lot of what you have said doesn't seem to measure up with what we know the facts to be?
Well, Gonzalez, though, always had the fallback position, which was that if we reveal any details about this, then the terrorists who are undoubtedly paying attention to this hearing will know more than they should about our strategies.
Right. But on some questions, I found that, you know, it was a little baffling because at one point he was asked, when did this program begin? When did the administration reach the conclusion that it could do this without that it had the authority to do it? And Gonzalez wouldn't give a date. He gave a sort of rough time period.
So it might have happened then after September 11th?
We said after September 11th, but before the passage of the Patriot Act, which, of course, is late October of 01. So at least we've got a sort of six-week window there. We can assume that it began. But for some reason, he didn't want to say when. Another frustration I know on the part of some of the members is, like, the Attorney General had said that congressional leaders were consulted on whether or not the law needed to be changed to accommodate this program. Senator Leahy pressed him on that. And when was this consultation taking place? Because, you know, they only consult a very few congressional leaders, not the full committees. And Gonzalez said 04, to 2004, but then never said which members were consulted. And so far, I've yet to find any who says, yes, they remember having such a conversation with either the Attorney General or then White House Counsel Gonzalez or anybody else. So there's a lot of these sort of questions that didn't get any closer to getting answered.
And at one point, of course, the Attorney General said he didn't think it was really necessary to talk to the Congress, really raising the hackles of those who see here an abuse of executive power and the separation of powers between the Congress and the president. Well, what about the Democrats? And to what extent do they want to make a political issue this year, this election year, out of what they see as an abuse of executive power?
They're walking a fine line here because they know that there is a large portion of the public that is primarily interested in just in government keeping us safe, stopping another terrorist attack, do whatever you need to do to stop another attack on U.S. soil. And to the extent that they hit this too hard and the White House and the administration push back with that line, it makes it a very dicey as to how much political juice this issue has.
Michael Isikoff, again, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Come back to you in a moment. First, I want to go to Gary Langer, who's polling director for ABC News. And Gary, thank you for joining us.
You bet, Warren.
Does your polling bear out what we just heard from Michael Isikoff?
Well, to a certain extent, I wouldn't overstate it. It's not that Americans don't care about their privacy rights or other personal rights. It's that they see a give and take, if you will, among competing rights. And while people care very much about their rights to privacy, not to to suffer unreasonable searches and seizures, at the same time, people perceive a right to security, a right to be protected from terrorism. And that, at the moment, and frankly since 9/11, has been a greater concern. So people are willing to tolerate intrusions on their privacy. They'd rather have them be as limited and as targeted and as effective as possible. But in the push and shove of competing rights, terrorism is unquestionably the broader concern right now.
Can you give us numbers on that?
Yeah, just for example, I mean, it depends how you ask it. We ask people what's more important right now for the federal government to investigate possible terrorist threats, even if that might intrude on personal privacy, or for the federal government not to intrude on personal privacy, even if that might compromise terrorism investigations. And by 2-1, the public says investigate the threat. 65% say that's the more important choice. Now, that's down from its peak, which is nearly 80% closer to 9/11. So it's subsided somewhat. This is something that's really common over history. When the nation is perceived to be confronted with a crisis, as terrorism is perceived as being, people want the crisis dealt with and resolved. and they're willing to make sacrifices, including accepting the incursions on some rights, in order to solve that crisis, mm-hmm. to resolve it. When there is a resolution, if and when, and in this kind of case it's hard to know when that happens, then people tend to want their rights back and there to be fewer intrusions on privacy. But people are still concerned today about terrorism. And as long as intrusions on rights are targeted or done thoughtfully and done cautiously and are perceived as being effective, they're going to get support.
Gary Langer, again with ABC News, back to Michael Isikoff. At the hearing yesterday, you said the Democrats were walking a fine line. Could you see that in the questioning and in the kinds of remarks they made? Did they indicate that they might want to make a case about how limited and how effective, particularly, the intrusions were going to be? Did they try to make clear at all times that they, too, were worried about security?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. In fact, I mean, that was almost a sort of talking point for a lot of them, that don't think for a moment that we don't want to do everything we need to do to help protect the country and help you, give you the tools you need. We just want to do it under the law. And I think as this political debate escalates, you can almost feel the tensions growing, because you get the comments from Karl Rove and others saying that there are these two competing views of the world about whether the government needs to listen in on al-Qaeda conversations. We believe we do. You know, the Democrats have a different, you know, if there's somebody from al-Qaeda speaking to somebody in the United States, we believe that the government has a right to listen in on that conversation. You know, that's our view. The Democrats have a different view. Well, the Democrats resent that kind of
So what they're saying is, of course we want you to listen in. We just want you to do it in the approved manner.
Do it under law, I think, yeah. is what the argument. But look, at the end of the day, how much political traction this issue will get will probably depend to a great degree on to what extent specifics about the program and whether any abuses can be documented. One thing to watch here is the Attorney General was asked yesterday about whether information that's gleaned from these wiretaps and doesn't pan out, doesn't lead to a genuine al-Qaeda suspect in the United States. What happens to that? Mm-hmm. Is it retained? He did say that some of this information is retained. He didn't say for how long, where does it go, and what databases does it rest, and whether others have access to it. And I think that's a ball to watch here, because I think almost everybody believes, as in most in these kind of programs, most of what they do doesn't lead to any genuine al-Qaeda operatives in the United States. There have been precious few that have actually been caught, arrested, and detained.
Washington Post says maybe 10 people out of thousands, I believe they have said, although they can't specify thousands were actually
so
suspicious
we know,
enough to get their calls intercepted.
Right, right. If those numbers are anywhere close to the truth, we know that almost all, but certainly a very large number of people that they're listening into, leads to nothing and are entirely innocent. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what becomes of that of the taps on those phones, of the transcripts of those conversations? Do they, and the names of people identified?
Let me go back to Gary Langer with the with ABC News. Does this begin to look like an issue for the Democrats, who, and I think this is sort of a subtext here, appear to be perceived still, as they have for many years, as weaker on defense and security than the Republicans are?
Frankly, I don't think it's a terrific issue for the Democrats. It works very well with their base, but they've already got their base. It doesn't work nearly as well with the center, with the independents and the moderates who are perhaps more willing to give some room on these privacy rights in order to get terrorism investigations done. Indeed, two points I think are important to know. One is that views on this issue are very highly partisan, with Democrats much more skeptical of the administration's techniques here, Republicans much more supportive, and independents more in the middle. But the movement we've seen since the story first broke has been slightly, but significantly, in the president's direction.
Mm-hmm.
In our most recent polling, 56% of Americans said these wiretaps without court authorization were acceptable. Now, it was up 6 points from when the story broke. In a Pew Center poll, very good poll just out today, very similar result. 54% say this is generally the right thing for the government to do. Again, up 6 points just in the last little while. So what movement has occurred has been in the president's and in the administration's direction. And that underscores the strength of the argument that investigating terrorism is paramount.
All right.
That is something that resonates.
Gary Langer, once again, the polling director for ABC News. I want to read very briefly from remarks made by Bruce Fein. He's our next guest. Constitutional scholar, worked at the Justice Department under President Reagan and President Nixon, I believe. Also writes a regular column for the Washington Times. And he's quoted, and Mr. Fein, I'll introduce you in just a second, as saying that if the president is unwilling to delineate anything that's out of bounds, no matter what Congress says, then you're establishing a principle of trust me as a measure of our civil liberties. And at that point, you have to start talking about impeachment. Bruce Fein, welcome to our program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Impeachment?
I don't think that we ever acknowledged that we could have King as a president and keep him in power. Certainly the founding fathers would have thought that was the first and primary standard for an impeachable offense, high crime and misdemeanor. It's what Alexander Hamilton styled a political crime against the institutions of government.
You have worked for some conservative presidents. You write a column for a conservative paper. Do the Democrats have an issue here?
Well, I think they do if it's framed properly. I'll alert your readers. I voted for President Bush twice and have defended the majority of his claims of authority. But let me, if I could, I think, correct a couple of things or amplify on what Mike said. First, with regard to the claim that this needs to be done to promote safety, the perhaps the most sensitive calls that need interception would be domestic-to-domestic calls by Al-Qaeda. And those are not being intercepted under this program. And when Gonzalez was asked why, he said, well, the president feared a public outcry. So the kind of interception that could have thwarted 9/11 is not being undertaken. The claim that there, and moreover, Gonzalez said, we are satisfied with using the FISA process to intercept those calls, which require the general finding that there's probable cause to believe you've got a foreign agent or a lone terrorist out there. FISA is good enough for domestic-to-domestic interceptions. So we have to ask, well, what is it that he's claiming is this a great emergency? In 1990, the United States Supreme Court held that the Fourth Amendment has no applications to aliens and territory outside the United States. So any Al-Qaeda call coming into the United States can be intercepted without any cause at all by the NSA before it enters into the United States. There has never been an obligation under any law for NSA to stop monitoring if an American picks up the phone on the other line. What the issue is whether, although this isn't expressly stated, you can deduce it by the concession by the Bush folks that what they are doing is covered by FISA, is that they are targeting American citizens on American soil without getting a judicial warrant. The same kind of monitoring that they say they are getting judicial warrants if it's a domestic call to a domestic call. So there's a total illogic in this this issue, and the administration has been able to confuse the American people by not describing exactly what it is they're doing to circumvent FISA. Now, the other thing to be noted—
Mr. Fein, I'm going to have to ask you to pause for a moment. We will all hold that thought until we come back after we take a very brief break. We've been talking with Bruce Fein, again, formerly with the Justice Department, now with the Washington Times. And I want to thank Gary Langer of ABC News and Michael Isikoff of Newsweek magazine for being with us. We'll continue this conversation with Bruce Fein. We'll have others as well in just a moment. On Reporter's Notebook, how did the protest over cartoons of Muhammad go from Denmark to the rest of the world? Back in a moment on that on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point, once again talking about the surveillance of Americans by the NSA, the National Security Agency, and whether the president is, as he claims he is not, subject to the Foreign Intelligence Security Act, or FISA, which set up courts to be used, it is claimed by Democrats and some Republicans, for that purpose. We're talking right now with Bruce Fein, constitutional scholar, worked in the Justice Department under Presidents Reagan and Nixon, and writes a regular column for The Washington Times, who has used the word impeachment in this context, even though he is a supporter of President Bush. So, Bruce Fein, let me go back and let you finish your point. Go ahead.
Well, the second thing to underscore here is the president's argument that when the Congress authorized the war against Afghanistan, Taliban, and al-Qaeda, they were overriding FISA is preposterous on its face. First of all, FISA is not indirect in its regulation of electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes during wartime. I was here the time of the Church Committee hearings in 1975 and 1976, which laid the foundation of FISA. It was disclosed that over 30 years, NSA, FBI, CIA had been involved in illegal opening of people's mail, of intercepting international telegrams, of putting people on watch lists, not for intelligence purposes, but for criminal justice purposes. And in that background, in the history of executive branch abuses of civil liberties during wartime, remember World War II and the Japanese-American internment or concentration camps, there would be a regulation, not a prohibition, a regulation of electronic surveillance. And the Act provides, this is in Section 1811 of Title 50, who everyone wants to look it up, that during wartime, the president has an initial 15 days. He doesn't need any judicial warrants to go search for conversations or intelligence that might thwart a second edition of 9/11. And in the legislative history, it was discussed that 15 days would be sufficient for the president to come to Congress and ask for more time if he thought judicial warrants would be too slow in order to respond to the emergency. Now, that is about as clear as you can get in congressional expression of what they want to happen during wartime. Now, the president says, well, when Congress authorized the war against Afghanistan and said he used necessary and appropriate force, they really meant that they were to override and ignore FISA. Now, the problem was that, number one, every member of Congress denies that that was their intent. Number two, the president never said that was the intent when he signed the AUMF. Number three, he never told any member of Congress that this was the consequence. And number four, when the act was passed, he never received such advice that the AUMF enabled him to go outside FISA. That was something that was concocted like a surprise O. Henry ending 4 years later after the New York Times published the disclosure of the electronic surveillance by the NSA. So the Supreme Court repeatedly instructs a contemporaneous interpretation is given some weight, but not one that looks like it's after the fact concocted for a political reason. The president's basic theory, announced by Alberto Gonzalez, his attorney general, was that during wartime, irrespective of what Congress says, I can do anything I think is necessary to collect intelligence to fight the enemy. For example, he could break and enter homes. That's another tactic that's covered by FISA. He could engage in torture or degrading or inhumane treatment if he thinks that would extract some kind of intelligence, even though it's prohibited now by the McCain Amendment. He could stick us in internment camps if he thought that, in his say-so alone, we were aiding and abetting al-Qaeda. Some of his supporters have even gone so far as saying under the proper theory of war power, he could shoot anybody on the street in the United States that he suspected of being an al-Qaeda supporter because they're enemies in wartime, and if you could shoot them on the battlefield, and the battlefield is all the world, you can shoot them on the sidewalks of the United States. That is how extreme this theory that the president is propounding can carry things. Alberto Gonzalez didn't say that the president doesn't have authority to do these things. He just said he's not doing them now, and therefore they're hypothetical. Now, that's pretty chilling in my judgment.
Is that where you then move to the idea that if the president persists in this and continues to use the powers that he has claimed in the way that we believe he has, he ought to be impeached?
If he says, I have that power to shoot anybody on the sidewalk who I say is al-Qaeda, put us in internment camps, violate FISA,
well, but he hasn't
open our
mail, said,
yes. Okay. The answer is yes. If he says those, that
well,
is...
If he doesn't say shoot people or intern people or torture them, but just says I can violate FISA, that's enough in itself?
If he... Well, we have to ask him why. Are you just picking and choosing FISA just for the sake of it? What theory suggests that you can't violate the mail statutes or violate the provisions against torture? He can't just stand there and mum, like he said before, just trust me, I'm not a dictator. Our civil liberties have never depended upon just trusting the president. They've depended upon checks and balances in the rule of law. And if he says, you know, I just violate whatever laws I feel like violating right now, it's FISA, then I believe it's time to impeach and remove him from office.
All right. Bruce Fein, formerly with the Justice Department under Nixon and Reagan, writer of a regular column for the conservative Washington Times. Let me introduce another guest, lawyer, fellow lawyer, and one of the authors of Powerline blog. Also writes for the National Review and the Weekly Standard, both the conservative outlets. He's John Hinderocker, and welcome to you.
Hi, Warren.
What do you say to what we're just hearing, that the president is on the verge of an impeachable offense?
It was completely over the top. I mean, President Bush isn't talking about shooting people or setting up internment camps. We're talking about a very specific and very limited program. And as far as that program is concerned, Bruce's complaint isn't with President Bush. It's with the federal courts. There are at least five federal appellate courts that have specifically held that the president has the inherent authority under Article II of the Constitution to conduct warrantless surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes. The federal courts have consistently and unanimously held that the president has that inherent constitutional authority.
Does it have to be during time of war?
Yes, no, these decisions stretch out from 1970 to 2002. No, it does not have to be during time of war. In 2002, the FISA appellate court, the very federal appellate court that oversees the FISA Act, wrote, and I'm going to quote them here, "The Truong Court, as did all the other courts to have decided the issue, held that the president did have inherent authority to conduct warrantless searches to obtain foreign intelligence information. We take for granted that the president does have that authority. And assuming that is so, FISA could not encroach on the president's constitutional power." That's really the end of the conversation. The NSA program is legal. It is constitutional. There really isn't any doubt about it.
Let me ask you this. Yesterday, Chairman Spector asked the Attorney General why he didn't go to the FISA court and asked it to take a look at what it was doing and get a ruling. And the Attorney General really didn't ask it straight out. Why do you suppose they're not doing it?
Well, Gonzalez has answered that question many times, and he's answered it very clearly. The vast majority of the time, the administration does go to the FISA court. But there isn't always time to go to the FISA court. Most people don't understand that to get a FISA warrant is a very complex process. There's a long series of requirements that have to be fulfilled before a judge can sign a FISA order. There's this 72-hour so-called emergency provision, and some people say, well, if speed is an issue, just use that. But it's not that simple, because in order to use the 72-hour emergency provision, the Attorney General has to certify that the requirements of FISA are being met and that within 72 hours a judge's signature can be obtained. And for the Attorney General to be able to certify that requires multiple opinions from lawyers. It requires filling out forms and filling out affidavits. There's a process. If you just look at the statute, it's obvious that the process would take at least days, if not weeks.
But let me ask you this.
If you don't have days or weeks to start surveilling a terrorist, you have to use the constitutional mechanism rather than the FISA procedure.
But Bruce Fein just said that, according to the Attorney General, I gather in his testimony yesterday, that domestic calls by people in al-Qaeda are among those where the Attorney General said that FISA is working just fine.
Well, I don't know about working just fine. Clearly, under the prevailing federal law, the president would have the authority to order that domestic surveillance. He's chosen not to do so. He thinks it's most appropriate not to do so. I'd kind of like to see him do it.
Okay. Again, John Hinderocker with the National Review, Weekly Standard, lawyer, of course. Bruce Fein, another lawyer. Back to you with the Washington Times. You've just been accused of being over the top. And what do you say to the arguments of John Hinderocker?
Several. First, the courts have never held that the president is empowered to ignore and to violate FISA. Everyone except the last decision that he cited with regard to the federal FISA appeals court addressed issues of the president's power before Congress has enacted FISA, or if it came after FISA with regard to Truong, it was a search.
Yeah, but he just quoted
before.
From a FISA
so they're just,
decision.
They're just
saying
not applicable because they didn't have to do with FISA and the president's attempt, as here, to to flagrantly circumvent it.
Secondly, what about the FISA decision, the inherent right to have warrantless searches?
Right, inherent, meaning that if Congress has not acted, the Supreme Court has always differentiated cases where Congress has been silent or supported the president's authority, as opposed to cases where Congress has said the president shall not do this. This comes from Youngstown Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer 1952 decision. And in FISA, the Congress specifically says, we want the president's power to be at its lowest ebb here. We're telling the president, if you're going to conduct surveillance in wartime, this is how it's to be done. And no court has ever held that that provision of FISA is unconstitutional. Secondly, with regard to what's going on, yesterday at the hearing, Gonzalez refused to say what's going on. He said, well, the president has enabled me to tell you, so this is the part of the surveillance program that I'll tell you about. There are other parts that simply are not part of this hearing, and you don't know about them, nobody knows about them, and we aren't going to tell you. And there is nothing that the Attorney General said when questions were raised about the hypotheticals that I have shared with you, where he said, no, the president doesn't have power to do that. He simply said, well, the president isn't doing it now. Not that the president didn't have authority to do that. And lastly, with regard to this idea that FISA is too cumbersome, not only is the point that you made well taken, how come it's good enough for domestic-to-domestic calls, where Gonzalez did not say that's a problem. In July of 2002, this is, at least 8 months after the electronic surveillance program was begun that you didn't know about and I didn't know about or anybody else, the Justice Department, John Ashcroft's Justice Department, speaking for the president, went to Congress and said, FISA is working beautifully with regard to the 72-hour emergency provision. It enables us to be nimble and speedy and quick to respond to instant emergencies. We don't ask for any further changes in FISA through additional amendments to the Patriot Act. Indeed, the Patriot Act amendments that were acted in October of 2001 are working splendidly. We don't even want to reduce the level of proof from probable cause to reasonable suspicion in order to surveil non-U.S. persons or aliens.
Okay, so John Hinderaker, back to you. Isn't there a contradiction there?
Well, the contradiction is on Bruce's part. He's simply wrong about what the FISA appellate court said. They wrote, quote, FISA could not encroach on the president's constitutional power, close quote. A lot of people don't understand that the executive is a co-equal branch of government. Congress cannot take away the president's constitutional powers by statute any more than the president can take away Congress's constitutional powers by executive order.
But does the president have the power to do whatever he wants and override the law?
Of course not. No one's talking about overriding the law. The governing law here is the Constitution. Everything the president does is subject to the Constitution. That's why he can't round people up and put them in internment camps or start randomly shooting people on the street. I mean, this is nonsense.
What about this point about FISA? If it's so cumbersome, why would the administration have said that it's working just fine? Why don't they ask now for it to be amended?
Well, what they've said is it doesn't need to be amended. They've got the authority they need in their inherent constitutional powers.
Okay.
There's no reason to amend FISA. It's the Fourth Amendment that governs, and the Fourth Amendment simply says that searches and seizures must be reasonable. I think, and I think most Americans think, it is reasonable to intercept the communications of al-Qaeda agents.
Let me introduce yet another attorney, one who has been counsel to both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, has worked under Democratic Representative Jane Harman of California and the Republican Senator, now chair of the Judiciary Committee from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter. She's also former Assistant General Counsel to the CIA. Suzanne Spaulding, thank you very much for joining us today. Do you think that the Congress is in a position right now to act if, in fact, Senator Specter is right and Senator Graham is right and John Hinderaker is wrong and Bruce Fein is right with regard to the law in this area?
I don't think Congress is ready to act. It was clear from the hearings yesterday that Congress really knows very little about the nature of this program or other programs. I thought it was interesting yesterday when Gonzalez was asked about the controversies within the administration. He made it clear that those disagreements and controversies were not about this particular program, as he said that the president has confirmed, but were about other activities. So there are clearly other activities as well as this program, and Congress needs to educate itself about what exactly is going on before it can even begin to think about whether there are legislative amendments that are necessary.
Well, does Congress have the power to do that if the White House doesn't want to tell them?
Well, Congress has the power of the purse. And that's a pretty strong power. And the intelligence committees, I think, have a lot more authority than they have been willing to assert so far to demand that the administration come up and inform the committees exactly what's going on here.
Can that be done in secret so that Attorney General Gonzalez's concern about the revealing strategy to potential terrorists isn't a problem?
Of course it can. The intelligence committees get extremely sensitive information on a daily basis. And their track record, actually, on protecting that information is quite good.
You say that the Congress has this power, and it has the power of the purse if all else fails, and yet it, of course, has a Republican majority, and there's a Republican president in the White House. You don't actually think that politically the Republican Congress is going to do that, do you?
Well, I think they might, for a couple of reasons. I think we saw in the hearing yesterday that the concern over the legal authority for this program crosses both aisles. There were a number of Republican senators. Lindsey Graham was particularly articulate about the dangers of ignoring our system of checks and balances and why that makes us stronger, not weaker. I think there are Republicans who care about this. And I think there's an institutional prerogative at stake. If the president is allowed to decide which laws he wants to abide by, which laws he wants to ignore as commander-in-chief, Congress becomes irrelevant, certainly in that area. And I think there's a real institutional interest in making sure that Congress is not irrelevant.
So I take it you're siding with Bruce Fein on this question having to do with the courts, and particularly the FISA court, which John Hinderaker says has said that the president has the inherent right to conduct warrantless searches for intelligence.
I think it's important to know that the FISA Court of Review, when it talked about this issue, it did not reach a holding on this issue. In other words, it did not decide this issue. It was in the midst of a discussion about an issue that it was deciding, and it said, as you read, it takes for granted that the president has this authority. The cases it cited were all pre-FISA cases, and I think in taking for granted that the president has this authority, frankly, it made a mistake. It should not have taken that for granted. I do think, having said that, I think it's an open question whether the president indeed retains some residual authority, even in the face of FISA, in an emergency situation where an unforeseen circumstance arises and collection needs to be undertaken to protect the nation, and it doesn't comply with FISA. I think it's not unreasonable to argue that the president has the authority to protect the nation to order that surveillance, but it's based on a compelling need and no time to go to Congress. Over time, that compelling need dissipates, and after 4 years, I think it's pretty hard to argue why you should not have to come to Congress to seek to amend the relevant law.
All right. We are out of time for this segment of our program, which I'm sure is frustrating to our other guests. But we will continue this conversation, particularly if and when the intelligence committees take up this matter. And we'll see if Susan Spalding is correct, that there may in fact be some action on the Hill. Meantime, thanks to her, Susan Spalding, again, formerly with the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, John Hinderaker, columnist for the National Review and the Weekly Standard, Bruce Fein, columnist for the Washington Times. A lot of ways to look at this issue, and we will continue to pursue them as time goes on. Outrage continues over the cartoons of Muhammad published in a Danish newspaper. In Afghanistan, where 4 died during protests yesterday, 4 more were killed today. The Danish embassy in Tehran was stoned for a second day. Demonstrations are continuing in Indonesia, the Philippines, and other Muslim countries as well. Meantime, there have been new reports on how the worldwide protest began 4 months after the cartoons were originally published. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In Moscow today, the Sakharov Museum and Public Center said it would exhibit the Danish cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad to show solidarity with press freedom in the Western world. An Iranian paper has announced a competition for cartoons about the Holocaust. Meantime, the Prime Minister of Denmark, Anders Rasmussen, has called the protests a global crisis, and he's appealed for calm. Meantime, there have been more reports on the role of Muslim imams in Denmark, and David Rennie is Europe correspondent for the London Daily Telegraph. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hello.
Tell us a bit about the imams. They are being accused, if that's the right word, of orchestrating this protest, taking it to other Muslim countries. That appears, at least in part, to be true.
That certainly does appear to be true. There was a group of Danish imams and activists who initially tried to get this going in Denmark. They contacted ministers. They tried to arrange meetings with newspapers. They got frustrated sometime about a month after these cartoons were first published in September last year. They got frustrated and decided to take their case abroad. And now what they did, which is getting them a lot of criticism back home in Denmark, is they put together a dossier, a 43-page dossier, which contains the 12 cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that were published in the Danish newspaper. But they also put in some other material. And the most controversial thing they did is it turns out that they put in three extra cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, which are highly offensive, even obscene, which were not published in any Danish newspaper. And they put those at the back of the same dossier, which they then carried to Egypt and to Lebanon, where they met some very senior figures from the Arab League, some senior clerics, including the Mufti of Egypt and the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, who's a very influential figure in Cairo. Now, the question mark is, did they make it sufficiently clear that these three extra images were not published in the Danish press, and what were those images doing in the dossier? And certainly their work does seem to have set the ball rolling.
How widely publicized and distributed were these various cartoons? Did people in the street see them, or just the leaders that the imams spoke with?
Well, now, they're clearly out there, and I should be fair, I've been talking to these imams in Copenhagen for the last week. They say that these images were flagged up in the dossier as being not from the Danish press. What they say the story is that they were received by Danish Muslims as hate mail from racist white supremacist groups in Denmark, and they put them in the dossier to show the kind of atmosphere that exists of racism and Islamophobia, in their words, in Denmark. But there's a lot of question marks, and in particular there's question marks about some of the people they went to see, some of the people they sent the dossier to, people who are included on U.S. lists of terrorists, particularly a man who's very influential called Al-Qaradawi, Yusuf Al-Qaradawi. He's based in Qatar. He has a weekly show on Al Jazeera, and he's issued fatwas defending suicide bombs in the Palestinian territories, defending suicide attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq. He's taken very seriously by a lot of Muslims, and they sent the dossier to him. They spoke to some of his deputies who are in extremist groups in the Lebanon. And when they got back to Denmark, the Prime Minister, as you say, Mr. Rasmussen, really gave them a lot of criticism in public. He said that he was speechless, that people who were Danish citizens had gone out to the Muslim world to try and create trouble for their own adopted country. And where did their loyalty lie? And I think that's one of the big problems now, is this question of loyalties, and it's causing a lot of angst around Europe.
David Rennie, once again, Europe correspondent for the London Daily Telegraph. Yeah, when you spoke of Egypt and Lebanon and Saudi Arabia as well, to what extent is it politically convenient in those countries for the governments of those countries to have these demonstrations going on right now?
I think there's no doubt that a lot of this is to do with politics, particularly when you see some of the most aggressively secular regimes in the Arab world jumping on this bandwagon, for want of a better phrase, and like the Egyptian government, the secular Ba'ath government in Syria, which was condemning this. There was a kind of rush to denounce these things after it really took off in January. One of the interesting questions that people have a right to ask is how come it took so long for this to become a really big deal? These cartoons were published in September. There was sort of rumbling about this in the Arab media and the Arab world at various Islamic conferences, but it really only took off in January. The best answer I can get from different people is that during the Hajj in January in Mecca, you have 2.5 million Muslim pilgrims. At that time, there are a lot of conferences, little talking sessions, debates, and this issue really took off at that point. And immediately after that, you started to see the trade boycott against Danish goods in the Gulf Arab states. There were some very influential sermons in Mecca and Medina, which are televised. That's when it really started to take off in the second half of January.
How effective has the trade boycott been?
It's been pretty crippling. I mean, there are a couple of Danish companies, particularly a Danish dairy company called Arla, which is losing millions of dollars a day, and which is starting to say it's already laying workers off. It seems to sell a lot of milk and cheese and stuff in the Middle East. You can even see things like Nestle, which is, of course, a Swiss company, felt it necessary to place full-page ads in the Saudi papers last week saying Nestle would like to point out we're Swiss, we're not Danish, we don't buy any of our goods from Denmark.
Are there politicians and important public figures, religious and otherwise, in the Muslim countries who are now calling for calm?
We've seen a mixture of reactions. We've seen people calling for calm. Certainly the Lebanese government, which was initially one of those that was very critical, I think they really, really were extremely alarmed and shocked by the attack on the Scandinavian embassies in Beirut. That didn't suit them at all. They immediately put out these statements that we've seen about Syrian meddling and agent provocateur. We saw the interior minister resigning in the Lebanon. But we can now see this thing is taking a political life of its own. The Iranians are talking about trade sanctions against Denmark. It's very hard for the European Union to do anything to Iran because Iran is not a member of the WTO. We had an interesting situation last week when the European Commission was very outspoken against Saudi Arabia and said to Saudi Arabia that if they had any official involvement in the trade boycott against Denmark, that would be taken as a trade boycott against the entire European Union. They'd be taken to the WTO, but no one has that kind of sanctions against Iran. But in all these countries, in Iran, in Pakistan, even in countries like Mauritania, certainly in the Palestinian territories, you can see the Fatah and Hamas sort of vying to be the most aggressive about these cartoons. It's definitely swept up in politics now.
All right. Obviously, we'll be with us for some time to come. David Rennie, many thanks to you for being with us today. Again, Europe correspondent for the London Daily Telegraph. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Karen Radziner and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.